welcome once again to the Pedal Revolutionary Show. You're listening to 101.9 FM CITR here in the beautiful UBC campus, and we're here today celebrating freedom.
Yay.
Yay, freedom. Welcome again, everybody. It's a beautiful sunny day in Vancouver, perfect weather for cycling. We're just getting into the evening rush hour, so everybody watch your back and your front and your sides. Welcome to Emily Smith. Reverend Emily Smith is here with us today. Hi, Emily.
Hi, guys.
How you doing?
Well, I'm having fun.
Yeah, are you celebrating freedom today?
Oh, yeah, every day.
Nice. And we also have David Ripa on the board and Conrad Radical Schmidt. Hi, Conrad.
Hey, Emily.
Ooh, there we go. That was exciting. Okay, prosthetics at work. Just before we get started, I'd like to say, there we go. A couple of words. One is we had a bit of excitement on the last Critical Mass, as many of you are undoubtedly aware, and so we would like to get things started with a little bit of music, and here's a wonderful song going out to our benevolent Vancouver Police Department.
Female, right in the face.
Yes, I am female. A dangerous female. So watch out.
Do you ever feel angry? Are you paralyzed by your anger? Do you feel yourself with butterflies in your stomach a lot? Do you get headaches? Are you really frustrated? Do you ever get to the point where you're going to blow up and you're afraid that if you blow up, you're going to blow away all your friends and all your coworkers? Chances are, all of this behavior is a symptom of the fact that you're not expressing your anger. We can assertively express our anger if we handle our anger assertively. We complain and complain and complain. I'm angry. So what do? I want rage. I want to go home. I want sex. I want a cookie. I want rage. I want to go home. I want sex. I want a cookie. Really sorry? Did I really do something bad? Why am I apologizing? I don't think I'm always wrong. Do you? Do people push your button? Are they telling you that you're too fat, too aggressive, not nice enough, or just hard to get along with? Are they telling you that people who grew up in Connecticut are stupid? Do they tell you that you're weak? Are you simply the person who gets the sand kicked in their face? Negative, negative, negative. Now you're angry, and now you have something to say. I want rage. I want to go home. I want sex. I want a cookie. I want rage. I want to go home. I want sex. I want a cookie. I want rage. I want sex. I want a cookie. I want to go home. I want sex. I want a cookie. I want a raise. I want to go home. I want sex. I want a cookie. I want a raise. I want to go home. I want sex. I want a cookie. I want a raise. I want to go home. I want sex. I want a cookie. I want rage. I want to go home. I want sex. I want a cookie.
Right on. Well, who out there wants a cookie? If you'd like a cookie, you can call the station. It's 604 UBC CITR. Conrad, do you want a cookie?
Sex and a cookie, please.
Okay, so if anyone out there has sex and a cookie, you can also call the station. Again, that's 604-UBC-CITR. So today we're going to talk a little bit about the excitement of the last critical mass. And Emily and I have kind of had email conversations, but we've never actually met. And so thank you again to the Vancouver Police Department for bringing us together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is exciting.
It was really nice to meet you in person. For those of you listening out there, you may remember the iconic photograph of Emily standing out front of which church was it?
That was St. James Church.
St. James Church with her bicycle raised above her head in her robes. Do we call them vestments?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And a fabulous interview it was a column, wasn't it?
It was an article, yeah.
It was an article.
I wrote for Momentum.
Okay.
And I was Miss December.
Mm-hmm. We have such a multicultural going on. Mm-hmm. So you are pretty well known to the community, but you have your fingers in a lot of different pies, right?
One or two.
Mm-hmm. One or two pretty big pies, maybe,
yeah.
Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much for coming in to see us today. And maybe let's talk a little bit. I'd really like to hear your story about Friday night.
Sure. Well, it was one of those should we or shouldn't we, is it going to rain, is it not going to rain nights and critical mass. And I hadn't been for a while because I seem to always have meetings on Friday evening. So this was like, oh, good, no meeting, I'm going. And it wasn't raining. And I had accidentally left my helmet at church, and the custodian had locked it in the flower room. So I had this cute little cycling hat that a friend had given me, so I popped that on my head and headed down to the Mass, and it was great. We had a great gathering, a great group. We were riding around. We were having fun. We were behaving ourselves, more or less. I rode by the church and waved at the new rector's wife and son as they were going, the little boy was going to bed. And we went up Hastings and returning on commercial when I noticed Doug Gook, who many of you know. He's one of our great shouters on the Mass. He's got a great voice.
He's Hummer is for Bummer. That's him.
Is that him? He's great. Anyway, I noticed, like, he's a great big guy, right? And he was he was corking a car, and he seemed to be having some sort of difficulty with the two enormous men who were in the car, who I realized when I went to his aid were Vancouver police.
Oops.
I know. So, I can never resist a fuss, so I, you know, thought this poor young man needed my assistance, and I jumped in, and they promptly grabbed me and took me away by my arm, you know, one guy on either side. I thought this was pretty hilarious. And marched me over to the car, and after a few back and forths about what was my real name, sorry about that.
They seem to be confused about your name.
They were confused. I mean, I am too. I have several names, depending on who I'm talking to. Finally got it all straightened out, and they gave us a ticket. A ticket or two. We got two tickets, but there it was quite amazing because there ended up being five Vancouver police cars with all their assorted police, and the whole thing took about half an hour. And
you're a pretty dangerous lady.
I know. I never knew it.
Either that, or there were no other crimes to solve.
Nothing else going on.
Which is great.
On Friday night, we jumped back on our bikes and rode up the street, and then we saw this cute young lady with bunny ears. Oh, no, they're not arresting Miss Bunny, are they? And apparently some other noble woman had engaged in confronting the police when they were harassing a young man named Dave.
Yes. Women are pretty helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, men are very helpful, too.
Mm-hmm. But we seem to be throwing ourselves in the fray to help the boys. So I'm proud of us.
Well, that's lovely. That's an interesting story. And so so the outcome was that you got a ticket, and how much was your ticket?
My ticket was only $29. I don't know.
That's a bargain.
I know. It sounds like you and Dave got heavier tickets.
We got heavier tickets, and there wasn't a specific, like, checkbox for being mouthy or anything like that.
So bunny ears. I thought the bunny ears were, you know, out of line.
I should have definitely been heavily fined for wearing fur, I was actually at the front of the ride.
Oh, okay.
And so me and the Fixies were kind of, we had to stand to pedal. I was riding my little
Your children's bike.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Which, it's a pretty cute bike. And I thought I looked pretty cute with my bunny ears, but that didn't get me very far, which is commendable considering it's hard to resist the charm. And as we were riding up Commercial Drive at the pedestrian controlled light right by Britannia Community Center, there was a police car that was actually kind of oncoming, and it slowed down just before that light as we passed it, and proceeded to then stop on a green light and sit there for a little while, kind of ruminating, I suppose.
Right in the middle of traffic.
Right in the middle of the, yeah, exactly.
Okay, the road, yeah.
Yeah, well, it stopped on its side, and then it put on its flashers just as the light turned red, and oh my goodness, guess what? Dave is here too.
It's our fellow felon.
Come on in, Dave. Hi. We're just swapping. We're commiserating at the moment. So he flashed his lights and then stopped, and then he turned his lights right off immediately, and then sat there until the light changed to red, and then sat there through the red light. And as the light was still red, even though the mask kept coming, this car actually drove diagonally into the other side of traffic to block. Some of the mass. So the mass kind of got narrowed. There was a little bit of an hourglass there, and or a bottleneck. Just as you did, I stopped immediately. I think a lot of us who maybe feel like we can be calm or helpful in those situations, just our, in our nature to stop and help. So I just kind of stopped where I was, just past where the police officer was, and watched to see what would happen, because their intentions really weren't very clear. And they didn't seem to do anything at first. They just watched everybody keep going. So I kind of just stood there, and people passed me, and I waved to them and was just kind of happy-go-lucky. And then the police got out of their car, and they were very focused on the oncoming riders. And then eventually they found, like, kind of the last guy without a helmet. And he was a little bit near the back. And I'll pass the story over to him because he's here now. Hi, Dave. How are you doing?
Not too bad.
Yeah, you got to get real close to the mic here. There we go. We'll get to be good buddies.
So, a little sway from the ride.
That's okay. You just rode your bike here, hey?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a nice uphill journey.
Super. Well, do you want to just kind of pick up the story from there? And what did the police say to you when they approached you?
Well, everybody had gotten through, and I thought that this was a road closure to make the street safer for our ride. And then I was really surprised when he pulled me over, and he told me that I had a ticket. I was going to get a ticket for a helmet violation. So I explained to him the situation, how, you know, there's lots of us, and it's a pretty generally a safe setting for everybody, and that it was actually my first day in Vancouver. But he would have nothing of it. And then you were kind enough to come back and see if you could be of hand. And he decided to drag you down with me. So
we went down together. So in a nutshell, and did you know, this is Emily. You remember her from the other night.
Yeah.
She only got, what did you say it was,
$29? I got a $29 ticket.
Really?
Like our ticket is weird because on the back it's got all these different boxes and it doesn't actually say an amount, but it says for bicycle infractions it costs $75, which I would take to mean lights or helmets or anything.
Yeah, so it was not clear. It's strange that they're issuing everybody different tickets, and I don't know, it just seems like a weird crackdown and an unorganized, kind of inconsistent way to handle bikers. So the whole thing seems a little fishy.
Those are pretty strong words.
There's a lot of emails flying around. I don't know if you've been seeing them, but they seem to be focusing mostly on this idea of the helmet, whereas I'm really sure that helmets had not all that much to do with it, especially in our situation in the first, when they stopped Doug and then myself. They just seemed to see us, and then when they... when we stopped, when I stopped, they weren't going to stop me. I just, you know, I turned back as well. And
you're just trying to be nice.
I was just trying to be nice. And what I noticed was, well, they said, oh, aha, and somebody else that doesn't have a helmet. So, I actually do have a helmet and usually wear it. It just was sort of a circumstance. I just didn't happen to have it on.
I'm in the same boat.
Yeah, I see you came in with your helmet.
And that's maybe what we should talk about a little bit, too, that... There has been a kind of a helmet debate, just as you say, Emily, and maybe we should also think about some of the other issues that are maybe more global here for us. That, you know, critical mass does commit a lot of infractions. We do commit we do violate the Motor Vehicles Act in a few different ways. Specifically, we run red lights and we do corking, which obviously brought Doug to the attention of the police. From what the officer told me afterwards, as I was speaking with him, he said that this wasn't a sting operation or anything. This was just them enforcing the bylaw, and they just saw an opportunity to do that, or they saw a situation where they felt that they needed to. Of course, the police have discretionary powers, and I felt that it was rather unfair that I was getting a ticket because, again, I had passed them. They had let me go. I voluntarily came back. And it becomes a situation where the people who want to enter into dialogue with them are actually the people who get in a sense targeted just by being there, and it encourages us to. It's a way of encouraging us to kind of leave people behind or to let them, you know, single people out. And I think it's really important that we maybe don't do that. There was an interesting comment made by Bruce Triggs recently on the Bell of Mailing List, and he said. He suggested that maybe, he said it's kind of interesting that the cyclists are being a little bit singled out by, and just for people's information, you might want to check out some of the new policies that are coming into play. Mayor Sam Sullivan has put together a kind of a package of reform for the city of Vancouver as far as public disorder goes, and you can see more details about that by going to his website. It's mayorsamsullivan.ca. And there were some questionable parts of the survey that preceded that, the release of a lot of that information, and particularly for us in the cycling community, because along with things like aggressive panhandling and defecation in alleyways, cyclists wearing helmets was included as something that contributes to public disorder. So whereas there was nothing about, for example, dangerous driving or driving with cell phones. So a lot of us did take that survey. You can see the results as well on his website. But Bruce Triggs said, quote, why are bikes and poor people singled out? How many driving car crimes are left out of the list that would really positively impact the city? Critical mass will wear helmets when all of Vancouver has housing. That's an interesting...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, he put that out there to see what maybe people's reaction would be. So how do you guys feel about... where Vancouver is going as far as... I know you're just new here, Dave, so
sorry,
welcome to
that.
Vancouver.
Yeah. Just to give you a bit of the background behind the incident for me, I have extensive biking experience in Calgary and Montreal, and there it is not a helmet. And I do realize Vancouver police, their concern for everybody wearing a helmet. But so it was quite unexpected for me to be confronted so strongly into not even a warning or anything like that, when across the country it doesn't seem to be, a hard-edged rule.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think, as I said, I do wear helmets and I do believe in wearing helmets, but I do think it's up, it's really up to people to decide how, I think of critical mass as a parade, more or less, and we're
yes.
having fun, and, we're not breaking any laws that the Santa Claus parade doesn't break, so,
So is critical mass different? I mean, I know there was an article in the Georgia Strait, or a little blurb here written by Matt Burrows, saying that there was a comment by Howard Chow of the Vancouver Police Department, and Constable Chow said that... They've been ticketing cyclists before, during, and after the mayor's announcement on November 27th about
helmet.
This.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, about helmet law. And he also said just because they're part of that group doesn't mean that they are above the law.
Mm-hmm.
So should critical mass be an exception? Does it have a different... Is it more focused? Does it have a different mandate than maybe just somebody going to the grocery store?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, as I said, I think it's a parade. So we're together, we're acting together, we're out and about, and we're not really causing very much trouble.
Safety in numbers.
Well, technically, it's not a parade.
Oh, Conrad, don't rain on my parade.
One of the ideas behind critical mass is that it has no organizers, and it's just a group of cyclists that coincidentally are cycling at the same time at
right.
the same place.
Right, right.
This way, there's nobody filling out any forms with the government, getting insurance, so that leader could be targeted.
Mm-hmm.
By it not being a parade or anything really,
mm-hmm.
besides a coincidence,
right.
it makes it difficult for law enforcement to come down and where is your leader?
Right. They did actually ask that on Friday night. They wanted to, who's in charge? When we had the five police cars, and, you know, a lot of the cyclists had come back, so there were several dozen cyclists. There was somebody trying to find out who was in charge.
Who was in charge, Emily?
I don't know. I think it was that girl with the bunny ears.
What? No, I thought it was some reverend from some place.
No, that's a secret.
Oh, okay.
The Bunny and Reverend Alliance. But I wanted to share, maybe if I could, a quick funny story.
Sure.
Of who is your leader, because this one always cracks me up. Okay, this was about 4 years ago, and it was after a party at Jane and Russell's place, and maybe it was five. Actually, I think it was 5 or 6 years ago, and I don't know where the idea came from, but everybody at 12 o'clock decided to have a naked bike ride downtown.
Oh, heavens.
That's where it all started.
Mm-hmm.
And so the ride proceeded downtown, and on the way back, some lunatic came up with the idea of going over the Canby Street Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Do you realize
what's lunatic?
What's on the other edge of the Canby Street Bridge?
I do.
I think, isn't there a very quite large and ostentatious police station?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And what do you think happens when a group of naked cyclists go cycling for the first time past a large, ostentatious police station?
All the police lose control, get on their bikes naked, and ride with you to the Tim Hortons.
That's why the bunny ears happened.
I think the bunny ears have done something to my brain.
So anyway, all the cyclists
start... They didn't set the dogs on you, did they?
All the cyclists start yelling.
Oh, no.
This seems to attract the attention of some police. The police... the ride breaks up into four different groups.
Mm-hmm.
The police... I think they all go after one particular group, and they ask
the one you're in, no doubt.
So there's this one lady naked on a bicycle, and the police pull her over, and they had two questions for her. I always laugh about them. Guess what the two questions were?
I have no idea.
One is, who is your leader?
Take us to your leader.
And the second one, show me some ID.
So she reached in her virtual pocket and... Wow, so what happened in the end?
Well, there wasn't really that much. Everybody continued on the bike ride. The police let everybody go, and they made everybody promise that once they got to the end of the destination, they'd stop the ride. They were actually kind of friendly, helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody was arrested. Nobody was ticketed.
They didn't join in.
And for the rest of our lives, we will always be laughing about those two funny questions.
Well, and that raises some... I mean, for those of you who were on the ride on Friday, there was a lot of confusion around maybe why I was the only one put into the paddy wagon. And it has to do with driver's licenses. Mm-hmm. And being stubborn, I did not. I really didn't want a ticket. I really felt that it was symbolic, and I was dumb enough to persist in not giving my name because I really wanted the police officer to let us rejoin the group. And I felt that it was that we were different from mm-hmm. just a couple riders on the street. And so that's why I was actually put into the paddy wagon, because I didn't provide my name. And there's a fabulous little short video that Bob Alstead was kind enough to take of a really dangerous and raging bunny rabbit being put into the Vancouver paddy wagon. So if you'd like to see that, it's quite short. You can go to the Pedal Revolutionary blog. You go to pedalrev.blogspot.com and click on the link there. So once I was put into the paddy wagon, I had a minute to kind of like see the kerfuffle, because by that point the other cyclists from the tail had kind of caught up and were like, right. What's going on? This is so weird. I had my megaphone on me, so I was handcuffed actually kind of with my megaphone in the paddy wagon, which is, I don't know if any of you have been in a paddy wagon. It was my first time, at least in a Canadian paddy wagon, and they have like these little separate holding cells in them, so it's like and everything's stainless steel, so you can pee and vomit to your heart's delight. So it was kind of funny because I just slipped out of my handcuffs because I realized that they really weren't on very well. So I phoned a friend of mine, and I was really tempted to make proclamations with the megaphone, you know, or try the siren button. But then I thought, being in a small stainless steel room with a really loud my siren is quite loud, would be a bad idea. We started driving eventually, and I kind of thought, well, they're probably going to take... I know that one of my fellow riders came up kind of across the street to where we were, and outside the paddy wagon, he addressed one of the officers and says, well, if she just gives you her name now, can you let her go? And the police officer was like, well, she should have thought of that before, and it's too late now. And so I thought, well, I'm in it now. So then we drove for a little while, and I figured we were going to the Main Street Police Department, but we pulled over, and I thought, oh, my God, we're here. We're going in, like, the back loading bay or something, because it looked kind of unfamiliar. There is a little window in the paddy wagon cells. And as it turned out, we just went to a nearby parking lot, and the door opened, and I thought, oh, no. I'm really in it, because we're just in the middle of nowhere. But the officer with whom Dave and I had been speaking, I had mentioned to him during our conversation that I strongly suggested that he use his discretionary powers, and I encouraged him to maintain the good relationship that Critical Mass has with the Vancouver Police Department. And on that note, he said, well, you mentioned something about using discretion, and I just... I'd like to move forward with this, and I'd like it if you would give me your name, and I'll give you a ticket. But it's just cosmetic. I won't. You can contest it, and I won't show up in court. So that'll mean that you won't have to pay any money, and we can just kind of get out of this situation.
Did you get that in writing?
Oh yeah. Well, you know what? This is actually not the first time this has happened to me. We had a nice connection. He told me all about the pressure that he's getting from his bosses, and how, you know, this is something that I would say to everybody out there, you may want to think about the implications of not wearing a helmet, because there is a crackdown at this point. Do keep that in mind, and so they are getting pressure, and I don't blame the guy. He was certainly kind enough to take the time to have a conversation with me at length. It was just, the problem was, like, if you get anywhere like that with authorities, as I'm sure you know, Emily, once you get to a certain point where they can't outwit you, and they can't out-argue, like, they can't out-debate you, or they can't use logic on you, or they can't intimidate you, then they just give up and say, well, then we'll just arrest you.
Right.
But then they just let me go from there. So I walked and rejoined the mass. They had my bike with me, and oh my goodness, I hear some wind. Are we getting... Hello?
Hello.
Hey.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going fine. How are you?
Am I live on radio?
You are live on the board. Let me just say who the heck you are. You're not the VPD, are you?
No, I'm not the VPD, and I'm not here to arrest you. I bring good tidings.
You bring good tidings? Well, give it up, Nick.
Well, first of all, I'm sitting here right in the middle of the intersection at the East 10th Avenue Bike Route and Clark Drive, and it is ridiculous. It's just massive gridlock here, and
wow.
It being a wide and fast intersection, people are just whipping by left, right, and center. Ooh, there's a big truck. Hello, big truck.
Sorry, is this massive amounts of bicycles there?
No. People are just rolling by on their bikes, looking like they're having a great old time. Everybody's got their blinkies out. We're playing with some new BMXs, and it's all fun.
Ooh, so is it a little bit dark out there now? We're inside the studio.
Sorry, I can't hear you because of the cars.
Okay, so Nick, are you telling me that the cars are kind of in gridlock and the bikes are moving freely? Is that what
exactly.
we can...
Exactly. If you look up and down 10th Avenue, everybody's just rolling smoothly through. If you're looking on Clark Avenue, it is just stop and go. Whole lot of single occupant vehicles.
Do they look happy?
They do not look... Oh, there's one car with two people in it. No, they do not look happy.
Not even the people carpooling look happy. That's sad.
Well, kind of happy.
She looks kind of vacant, not happy.
Yeah.
Maybe she's thinking about how she'd rather be riding a bike.
By. Five or six bikes rolling through. This is awesome.
And so you're standing right near to the China Creek Skate Park, aren't you?
That is right. Actually, we're just going to roll right down there right now. I'm going to break a traffic roller shoot.
Okay.
Down towards the park where I can give you a clearer and better live on scene report.
Wow, it's funny. Some traffic reports have a helicopter interference. We've got wind.
And we have great news about the China Creek Skate Park.
Okay, I need you to stand out of the wind, sugar.
Hello?
Hi.
Yeah, we have some great news, potential great news about the China Creek Skate Park. The good news is that the Parks Planning Commission has totally flip-flopped in the face of overwhelming neighborhood opposition. and have decided to recommend that the park stay for the time being.
So they're saying, and this has been ongoing for a while, right? I know that the park's planning committee wanted to take out the skate bowl at one point, even though it's quite popular, and replace it with something small and crummy and put in a playground that would only be usable by a small portion of the population. But it sounds like you're telling me that they've decided not to do that?
No, there were two options on the table. One of them was for the removal outright of the bowls, and it was going to be replaced by a little learning area for really small kids. And we had a lot of local parents coming up in the meetings and suggesting that their little kids like to be around the bigger kids. It kept the bigger kids from getting into trouble, and you know, everybody got to be a great example for the kid. Once the kids outgrew that little area they were going to talk about, really there is nowhere for them left to go. And I'm talking about, you know, 13, 14, 15-year-old kids running around here.
Mm-hmm. That's super. So we can hear skateboarders in the background. What's the skate traffic like?
The skate traffic, well, it's pretty thin right now. There are actually no lights in this park, so it's kind of dim. Everybody's just sort of picking and threading their way around. My good friend Lyle is whipping through the bowls on his new BMX right now.
Nice.
And there's people just walking by, biking by. Some people have blinkies on, and it's great.
Wow. Well, that's...
As far as the process for the Parks Board is going, mm-hmm. on January 15th, there's going to be a final meeting where the Parks Planning Commission will present their revised recommendations to the Parks Board, and the Parks Board will go to a straight vote on it. Judging from the minutes of the last meeting, it seems that the Parks Board is actually really receptive to keeping the park here, where it's going to stay.
That's super. And I know, Nick, that you and people like Lyle and Skylar were really... I would think very important in raising concerns of the community and making sure that this process didn't go on behind closed doors. So thank you very much for doing that.
Exactly. Well, we really have to thank people like you and a lot of the local internet community for helping to get the word out. I know you're running your new cycling portal, and we've been trying to stir up word on sites like NSMB and Feeble BMX just to raise awareness amongst the local cycling community, because there isn't that much overlap between the riders and the more skateboard-oriented Vancouver Skate Park Coalition, who I can't say enough good things about.
Hmm.
A few weeks ago, they threw a giant Park Appreciation Day jam. Skylar and I showed up, and we were literally shaking because of just the energy level in here. It's a tiny park, and it was probably crammed with about 150 people of all ages just hanging out, having a great time. The old school Jack skateboard crew came through, totally representing. They're little tiny kids, barely, you know, toddlers even, on little toy boards with their parents out. And a lot of the older skate generation, they're having kids now, and it's great to see, you know, second or third generation skaters out here.
Cool. Well, and listen, if people want to get a hold of you to get more information, Nick, how do they do that?
I have a little piece of paper right here.
Great.
The best way to actually do it, to get more information, would be to go to the City of Vancouver Parks Board website, and that's at vancouver.ca/parks. And from there on, there's a whole bunch of links you can follow. But the China Creek Project is kind of buried deep in those links.
Okay.
And, oh no, I've lost my piece of paper.
It blew away in the wind.
Yeah.
I tell you what, if people want more information and they have trouble finding that link, you can send an email to pedalrevolutionary@gmail.com, and I will hook you up with Nick and the crew. Thank you so much, Nick, for calling in.
No problem, Ifni. Thanks for having us on.
Right on.
Get the word out about this.
It's
awesome that we've got people on board trying to see this great piece of community and cycling infrastructure in the city.
Okay, see you later. Take care.
Later.
So on that note, we're going to listen to a little song. It's called Let's Get Radical, and it's by Gogo Bordello.
Wow. Morning.
Let's go to Brighton Beach and the Parpoto Disco. Just
Поставь the foot in it, the foot, все будет хорошо. Some things are actually sacred. And tapping your foot to the ceremony just won't do.
That was, again, Gogol Bordello. I believe they're from New York City. Fabulous guys. So I just want to say a couple things before we get back in the groove. One is that, speaking of other reverends, I'd like to send out maybe congratulations, or hopefully congratulations, to the Reverend Phil down in Portland. He also was hauled in front of the law. He corked an unmarked police... He corked an off-duty police officer and his girlfriend during the World Naked Bike Ride in Portland. And unfortunately, that's situation became a little bit absurd really quickly. So he's now up on charges. He's facing a couple years in jail. And he went up before the judge just recently, and they've put the case forward to the 17th of January. So if anybody would like to email him with support or encouragement, feel free to do so and help him cover his legal fees, although I'm sure he's getting a bit of help on that. Also, if anybody is interested in hearing or in reading about some of the history of critical mass in Vancouver, you can do that in a couple of ways. One is by watching Bob Alstead's documentary, which is going to be shown again on January the 27th as part of a film festival. So congratulations to Bob, because that's pretty fabulous. That's going to be showing, let's see here, the 27th at 7 p.m. at Cinemark Tinseltown. So that's down in Chinatown. And you can also go to the Vancouver Critical Mass blog. So go to velolove.bc.ca, and when you get in there, click on history, and you can see some of the other incidents in Vancouver's past. We haven't had a police incident for years, maybe 7 years or so. So hopefully this will not be becoming a trend. I would also encourage people very strongly to review the new civil city policies at Mayor Sam Sullivan's website. They are going to be getting together to review things in February, so I really think if you have feedback, now's a really, really, really good time to give it to them. You can give them feedback either about critical mass or about some of the other policies that you may see there. And we're very lucky that we can do all this stuff. We're very lucky that we can speak to police officers and argue with them on the street and not get hurt. And Emily, I know that you've just very recently returned from Oaxaca, Mexico.
That's right.
And I'd like to hear, I'm sure a lot of us would like to hear about what you've experienced down there, because it's maybe the opposite of what we're dealing with here.
Yeah, I could give you a quick summary. It's a story that has, of course, about 500 years history, the story of the resistance of the indigenous communities. The Zapotec and Mixtec and the other 14 different indigenous nations of Oaxaca, in some areas, have never been conquered, quote unquote. They have never really been subjected to Spanish rule or to colonial rule, and they have maintained indigenous practices, agricultural practices, community authority practices for actually 10,000 years. The Zapotec communities have been up in what's now known as the Sierra Juarez, where I've been privileged to go a number of times. But recently, the last couple of years, there's been a descending state of repression against community organizations in Oaxaca, especially in about the last 20 years, and then the last 4 years really intensely, and in the last 2 years under the current regime of Governor Ulises Ruiz, who is a member of the Institutional Revolutionary Party, which is kind of an amusing name, but which is, of course, the one state party that Mexico was subject to for 70 years. That was this party, the PRI. So he's a member of the PRI party. He came to power through fraudulent elections 2 years ago and immediately clamped down on absolutely every kind of public protest. So no strikes, no protests, no occupation of public space, nothing at all. And one of the groups that was particularly targeted was a group called SIPO, which is the Popular Indigenous Council of Oaxaca, and one of their leaders, Raul Gatica, who's a Mixtec Indigenous leader. He has actually been in exile in Canada for about a year and a half, forced into exile through the acts of violence by this governor. So what happened to SIPO was kind of a pre-taste of what was going to happen and what has been happening in the last 7 or 8 months. In May of last year, the teachers went on strike. The teachers in Oaxaca are notoriously rebellious. They've been a real powerful force for organizing, not just around their own issues, but particularly around the needs of rural communities, rural children. They are teachers in these communities, and they're witnesses to the horrific situation of the indigenous rural population. So teachers are amazing in Oaxaca, just to begin with. So they went out on strike in May, and part of their strike, they were occupying the central square, tens of thousands, about 70,000 teachers, and they were on a rotating occupation of the central square of Oaxaca. And on the 14th of June, there was the state police assault on the teachers. And it was an incredible, horrific day. There were helicopter attacks, a number of people injured, killed, disappeared. And on that day, numbers of people arrested. But finally, by the end of the day, what had happened is that the Oaxaca city is about 1 million people. Well, it seemed like most of them actually got out on the streets, and they corralled the police and they chased the police away. and the teachers reoccupied the central square.
Wow.
And they remained there. And what happened as a result of that, it was about 350 or more community organizations got together and formed something called the Popular Assembly of the Oaxacan Peoples, or APO, which was this huge umbrella group, which included everybody, you know, from the Marxist, Maoist, Trotskyist People's Liberation League to all the indigenous groups, the women's groups, students, everybody, the teachers, everyone was in this group. So over the summer, I was fortunate to visit in July and August and witness how this was expanding and escalating, the conflict between the popular organizations and the government authorities. Over the summer was growing. The work of APO was ever more courageous and spectacular. Creative, innovative, unbelievable kinds of things were happening, really focused on community activism, really beginning in the hearts of the communities, not really with the leadership. So things were, and I can't say again, as this is a radio program, how critically important radio was. I mean, I could talk for somebody who wants to do their master's or PhD on communications and wants to go write a history of Oaxaca resistance in the radio, that it would be a marvelous topic.
It's fast, cheap, and dirty.
Radio is amazing, and it's mostly all illegal because there is no function, there's no way to have any legal community radio. So they were occupying radio stations, they were taking over, there was a woman's action with pots and pans where they took over the commercial television station. They only wanted to make a declaration, but they weren't allowed to make the declaration, so they took the whole place over, and they ran it for 3 weeks with popular television programming. It was amazing, and also with popular radio. They shut that down. They murdered a number of the leaders that were protecting the antennas, and so that was taken over at the end of August. The next day, I was really depressed that day, and the next day, lo and behold, I heard the news that they had taken the radio station back. The government forces had taken the radio station back. Well, the popular organizations had turned around and taken every single commercial radio station in Oaxaca City. 12 radio stations were occupied all at once on that day. So, for a number of months, they were using all of the radio stations were being run by the popular organizations. By the end of September, there was the biggest military buildup in the history of Mexico ever, against a civilian uprising. And the movement against Chiapas had been greater, but that was an armed resistance. So it was scary. By the end of September, things were getting really bad. There had been sporadic attacks. There were about 2,000 barricades that were put up around the city by the popular organizations to prevent the free movement of death squads. So there were 2,000. They're all over the place, but they were constantly under attack every night. We were in constant contact with people every day, trying to keep on top of what was going on. But by the end of October, things had descended into really serious violence. On the 27th of October, there was an attack on a number of the barricades. The indie media journalist Brad Will from New York was murdered, and then three Oaxacans as well that evening. And then 2 days later, the government used this as an excuse. They said, look at this civil unrest. So they sent in the troops. So on the 29th of October was the invasion of Oaxaca City by the PFP, or the Federal Police, Preventative Police, who were basically police army. I don't know what the difference is. The robocops with tear gas and cannon tanks and water cannons. And they're scary. On the 2nd of November, there was a successful defense of a number of popular sites in the city, of the university, which housed the last remaining radio station, and a huge barricade, which was up the road from the radio. So that was the 2nd of November, the heroic day. But there was a sense of impending violence, of continuing and increasing violence. So at that point, I made the decision that I actually had to... had to leave. I had to leave Vancouver and go to Oaxaca because I couldn't stand it anymore.
Wow.
So I did. I was just so fortunate to have support from everybody here, my mother and my kids and all of my friends. Everybody chipped in and, you know, helped me get this emergency plane ticket. And a few days later, I was in Oaxaca with the people I love, living in the SIPO house as a kind of a international witness and protection, taking care of of this place and this community. And it was an incredible experience. When I got there, I would say Oaxaca was an occupied state. There were police everywhere, thousands and thousands of police everywhere in the central square and all around. But there were still a lot of sites where there were movement, where you could, autonomous movement of people, physical sites and the radio. And there was a lot of, I don't know how to describe it, just kind of psychological, spiritual freedom. There was still, we were still spray painting the walls, and there's still a lot of dissent.
What was it like being in that house where you were witnessing?
Terrifying.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, if anybody wants to follow my experience, I was able to send letters back, and they are up on the SIPO Vancouver website, so anyone wants to read that. I've been doing this for 23 years. I've been involved in Latin American solidarity work, but this was definitely the most terrifying month of my life, living in this house. We were under constant threat of attack. We were having anonymous phone calls. We were under constant surveillance, and they were breaking into houses around Oaxaca City constantly and taking people out. So we don't actually know why we were never attacked, except for maybe because I was there. There were a few other internationals there, and we actually thought that because there was a lot of us praying our heads off as well. But what happened was on the 25th of November, there was a huge demonstration, a mega march, we call it, with tens of thousands of Oaxacans, teachers and women and indigenous leaders had come down from the mountains. And the idea was we were going to circle, the police were centered in the central square, the Zocalo. We were going to circle them and hold them for 48 hours. That was the plan. We did that, but very quickly, within minutes, it got out of hand. Some of our youth had slingshots, and some of them even had Molotov cocktails, but there were also instigators, government provocateurs within the popular movement who really started it. And as soon as the police sensed that there was any kind of provocation,
boom.
Yeah, everything, gloves were off, and everything changed. That night, I was describing to Conrad last night over a couple of bottles of wine, that night of terror. And yeah, boxes of wine. Yeah, we were down to the boxes of
wine.
Classy. Yeah, it was really fun. And we were on the street running all night long, basically. And it was terrifying. We were being, hundreds of people were rounded up that day. There's 63 people disappeared. There's been 20 people killed in all this time, and hundreds of people were taken to jail that night. And we were basically just moving from site to site, trying to find a safe place. We ended up in the university and the radio station, where we spent a huddled night in a lot of fear and a lot of worry for people who we didn't know where they were. So that was the night that everything shifted. The 25th of November, Oaxaca moved from being an occupied state to what I call a police state. And after that, there was to be no more joking around. There was no place or space for dissent anymore. The radio was shut down. The barricades were destroyed. All the communities that I came to support went underground. There was the final week I was there. I was there pretty much alone with one of the Oaxacans that was able to stay. So there is bike angles to this. I can tell you about them in another time because I think we're running short. But one of the interesting things was the barricades were really fundamentally important in the resistance in Oaxaca. And, of course, the only way to get around Oaxaca when the barricades were up was, you guessed it, by bicycle.
Yay!
And flip-flops.
And flip-flops, yes, that caused blisters later. But we actually had our barricade was on a site where there was the only bike route, I think, a bike lane in Oaxaca that's an old converted railroad track. So that was the Calicanto barricade on the bike route where Brad Will was killed. So I'd encourage Canadians listening to get in touch with SIPO Vancouver for more information around Oaxaca. We are organizing ongoing delegations, ongoing accompaniment of people to do human rights work in Oaxaca. And just to be aware, if you're one of these Canadians that visits Mexico, well, that's great, but I'd like to encourage you to think about it and to contact us to learn about ways to engage in ethical community building and ethical tourism. So thanks for having me on. And anybody wants to cycle to Oaxaca with me, I'm putting it out there. I really, 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 I mean it. Like, I was lying there last night, just sort of, I'm so miserable. I've been in this sort of incredible depression ever since I got back. I can hardly get out of bed. I'm serious. So anybody want to cheer me up by calling me up and saying, I want to cycle to Oaxaca with you, because I'm hopeless. I can't change a flat tire, so I need somebody who can like, help. So,
well,
you
heard it, everybody. If anybody's interested, you can phone the station at 604-UBC-CITR if you want to run away to Oaxaca with the lovely and terribly, terrible influence, Emily Smith. Mm-hmm. You can also contact her, I would assume, through the SIPO website. There's a link. Either do a search under SIPO, it's C-I-P-O, or you can go to the Pale Rev blog and find it there as well. I know we're running out of time. I think we can go until 6 o'clock just talking to you because you're pretty interesting.
Oh, thanks.
I wanted to ask you what you think that we can learn from what you've seen.
In Oaxaca?
Mm-hmm.
Well, somebody, I was interesting, I was on CBC Radio this morning, and Anna Maria Tremonti asked me if I was a missionary. I just about had a heart attack.
Oh, no.
I said, oh, God, no.
Did you blanch?
Yes. I said, of course not. Heavens no, I think I said. I think the idea is long gone that we up here in the north or the west have the story. We know it, and we're going to go give it to those poor people down there, wherever the down there is. I think that, and that also goes not just for Christian missionaries, but also for NGOs, for everyone who thinks they've got the answer, and those poor people down there, they just need development, or they need information, or, you know, they're messed up down there because of the way we're living our life up here. So we need to change our life up here to be have an influence on the way communities and just basically need to be left alone. And I think that, you know, I really do mean it about if people are interested in going, I am organizing visits and, you know, not necessarily by bike, but that is my personal goal. But it's an amazing thing for me. My whole life, my whole adult life, I've been in relationship with the people of Mesoamerica, and that has been the defining thing of my life, and mm-hmm. it's been a real gift. I think what they have not forgot, and what we're struggling to maintain here in our in everything from critical mass down to you know, all of this is about reconstructing and retaining, rebuilding community. Mm-hmm. So that's what we have to learn from our friends in Oaxaca.
Well, thank you so much, Emily Smith. It was lovely chatting with you, and
thank
very
you,
inspirational.
Mm-hmm.
And to everyone out there listening, please ride safe. We'll see you in a couple of weeks, and everybody take care of each other.
Mm-hmm. Stay out of the paddy wagon.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Flight 002 to Africa. Flight time will be 10 hours and 45 minutes. Cruising at an altitude of 40,000 feet. For your listening pleasure, there are 12 channels. So with your relaxation, enjoy some cool vibration.
3, 4. Yes, good evening. You're welcome to Afrobeat. And today's installment on Afrobeat contains the essence of two of Africa's most popular music. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. And some of these countries, well, no doubt have each contributed a volume or two of collections to the library of all-time popular music greats. And here we're about to explore a rough sketch of the scenic route through some of the West Africa's most vibrant music territory. So I just encourage you to sit back, relax. Our voyage today embraces the region's greatest pop styles and also, well, we'll visit some musical territories which are less well known in the West.